Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
So hey, it's Peter, and you are tuned to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast. For anything you hear on today's episode, I could suggest that you go to one of those social media platforms and send me a note. But then you're possibly sitting on the underground reading a copy of the Metro, and there's an article on the middle page, front page, saying if you drink too much coffee and follow the Sideshow at the same time, your ears will go pointy. You'll end up sitting underneath the tree, listening to the little people in Peter's head, banging pots and pans together, saying, how did we get in here? Can we not watch The Shawshank Redemption? And how do we get back out again? I don't even know how they got in there in the first place. And now, for some strange reason, I'm reminded of my conversation with Andrew Fisher Tomlin. In that, we ended up talking about Shania Twain, Steps, Too Unlimited. No, we didn't. Oh God, now I've got Too Unlimited in my head. What a terrible band. What music producer actually sat down and said, do you know what we need? Nope, not a new Beatles, not a new Rolling Stones, not a Jefferson Airplane. We need two people in tracksuit bottoms. One is to wear a bra and one is to wear a silky tracksuit top. And now I've gone totally off the point of the subject. So let me try and not bring this full circle, because I'm unsure if I could ever join those dots. But let me bring you to my guest, your guest today. He is no stranger to the Sideshow. He was on December 5th, if I'm open to correction. Let me find out what episode that was. December the 5th. It was episode 397. And whilst I might ramble ever so slightly, here's how that intro went.
Matt, you there?
Yep. Hello.
Am I allowed to call you Big Z like I call you down the pub, or do I have to do the official thing?
Well, I suppose it ought to be official. Big Z is just for my special mates, you know.
Well, people get certificates.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, yeah. Not very good ones.
Doesn't matter. About Sir Biggs?
Sir Biggs. No, I normally get called a lot worse things than that. You call me what you want.
Do you want to talk about your book?
Yep. Lovely.
Do you want to talk about... I'll talk about Gardener's Question Time.
Yeah, you can talk about them and a little bit about the book. That would be absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you need to drop in?
If I dropped in my shopping list for the weekend, would somebody go out and get me beans for me? Could do that. I mean, I wouldn't like to think that I'm lazy or so into plants that I can't even be bothered to shop. But
I'll drop it around to you tomorrow, Matt.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're coming round, can you just get us a couple of bottles of beer and some beans?
I don't like beans, Matt. Can I get you some Guinness instead?
Oh, Guinness. If you can get me some Guinness. Well, the thing is, you can only drink... Well, Guinness, to be honest with you, is the ultimate food, isn't it? So just bring the Guinness.
So you see, maybe it's not just me. Well, maybe you're the sane one, in which case now I have to query why you're listening to me in the first place. But I'm delighted to say that I have him back online. I have a book by him, don't I? I have a book. Hold on a second. I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll switch over to this other channel and we'll get Matt on the line.
Hello, Peter.
Matt, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Yourself?
I'm fantastic, Matt. Fantastic. Pleasure to hear your voice.
Splendid. So, RHS again. Let's go.
Yeah.
We're in the process of buying a kitchen, which is interesting. So, Jill, my wife, we're going to go and have a look at it today. I'm just going to do the right ooing and ahhing, I think, for this one.
That's called head nodding, Matt.
Isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. And any man who says different is full of something. Anyway.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Yeah. Are you in a quiet spot, Matt?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm in my office.
Okay. Well, let's go for this.
Thank you again for your interest in it.
Oh, Matt, I'll be really honest with you. It's a wonderful book, but there's the odd time you can turn around and say, well, that'll do. Couldn't have let the audio out. These things happen. I appreciate that.
Oh, listen, honestly, we were recording yesterday, and I'm glad you didn't. We were recording yesterday at Fulham Palace in West London.
Yeah.
And, the aircraft coming over, and it was stopped, start, stop. And the producer said to me, he said, you know, I'm sorry I had to be so fussy. And you go, it's your job to be fussy. It has to be right. You can't just let anything go out. It has to be of the required standard. So I don't mind at all.
Yeah, well, look, I can say what I want. I know I don't get paid for it, but I wouldn't let myself down by letting you down. And I had a picture in my head of Sue Biggs tuning into it going, that Donegan guy's a feckin' idiot.
Okay.
Matt Biggs, how are you? Pleasure to have you back online.
Well, lovely to hear you again, Peter. Lovely to hear you. You're sounding great.
Well, there you are. I'm unsure about that, Matt. There are people who might complain about hearing my voice again, but might turn around and say, Donegan, will you please shut up and let Biggsy do all of the very fine talking. Matt, congratulations on another new fantastic book. I have to say, it's a bit of an eye-opener. I'll quote you in a conversation we had offline, which is that I thought I knew everything about the RHS and the Royal Horticultural Society. It appears I don't, Matt. Is that a fair appraisal of what you have written or what A Nation in Bloom is all about?
Yes, funnily enough, I was of the same opinion. I thought I knew all about the RHS. And I don't think that you and I are alone. I think most people are of the opinion that they understand the Royal Horticultural Society. What most people are also going to be like, I think, is when they discover the background, as I did with the book, and all the things that are going on behind the scenes and why they do it and their motivations and their mission statements, the complexity and the breadth of what the RHS are involved with is absolutely mind-boggling. And I think people just go, do you know what? Chelsea Flower Show, Wisley Gardens, Harlow Carr, they list all the gardens, they list the flower shows, and that to them is the RHS. And do you know, having researched this book, it's a completely, it's not an erroneous opinion, it's not wrong, that is part of their work, but that's only a minute part of their work because of what they're involved with these days and how they've actually changed and are changing. It's an organization undergoing real transformation from what was essentially a middle and upper class gardening organization for people with nice gardens who like to potter and who love plants. And it's now being transformed under the guidance of Sue Biggs, the Director General, and those around her who are also aware of what's happening to horticulture. It's being transformed into something that helps people their mental health, with their physical health. It helps them come together as communities. It builds bridges. It educates children. Actually has an impact as far as global warming is concerned and climate change. So what used to be a little potter about sort of occupation for middle to elderly people has suddenly become this really dynamic, influential, impactful discipline or hobby that we call gardening or for those who work there call horticulture. So yeah, it's this understanding based on scientific research. And it's the way, I think, that they use their information that I found most fascinating. Well, one that immediately springs to mind is that they have an advisory service and people will contact them with a pest or a disease that they've discovered in their garden. Now, as well as offering the service of saying, this is what the problem is, this is how you control it, they then use that to document the spread of diseases, for example, or lily beetle or ash dieback, that those new diseases, and there are things like Agapanthus gormage, which were first recorded when somebody went to the RHS and said, look, I've got this problem. So not only with their pests and diseases are they solving the problems for gardeners, but they're also identifying new diseases and documenting in great detail their spread. And then they now have 19 people doing PhDs, and these brilliant scientists are developing their knowledge and our knowledge of particular pests or diseases. So, for example, there's been work done on work is being done on Agapanthus gormage, gormite, and they are developing the body of understanding. So, just from one query, they are gaining lots of information. And Interestingly, at the book launch last Tuesday at Hatchard's in Piccadilly, actually it was last Wednesday, and I was there. So it was last Wednesday. Last Wednesday at Hatchard's in Piccadilly, we had a book launch, which was lovely because Hatchard's in Piccadilly, the book fabulous bookshop, on that site, in a room above the bookshop in those days, the bookshop consumes the whole sort of vertical area these days because it's got so many titles. But there used to be rooms above there, and that's where on the 7th of March 1804, the Royal Horticultural Society was founded. So we had a launch there, which was really great to be in that particular place. But what Sue Biggs was saying was that, you know, they now have mission statements, they now have structures, they now have a positive direction. And the comment was made by, I believe, the president, Sir Nicholas Bacon, in a speech, was that, you know, if we don't do this, who will? And that's really powerful. If the RHS don't undertake a scientific research, develop understanding of gardening, of pests and diseases, who work on climate change, work out how gardeners can use water sustainably, make their own compost so, again, they can recycle. All these things are being done by the RHS as areas of research because nobody else would do them. And that's one of the real eye-openers for me, is that if it wasn't for this organisation, and they wouldn't say, and I did say this to Sue, I said, you know, nobody would say that the RHS is perfect. Nobody would, because nothing is. But what they're actually trying to do is trying to solve as many problems, look at as many different areas, and use these the multifaceted beast that is horticulture, and develop every facet of that to the benefit of the public, the gardening public, and of course with the knock-on effect that it can have on their well-being, you know, on the climate, on use of water resources, all these kind of things that impact not just horticulture itself, but the rest of the country, and I guess ultimately their research, their understanding of the development of the society in this way means that they will be able to influence the world. And that is hugely powerful.
Let's take this back and something you noted a little bit ago. Way back when, it was a hobby, a pastime that was seen as maybe, I say, play devil's advocate slightly here, but for the upper to middle classes only. At least when I was growing up, it was also seen and perceived as a hobby, or again, a pastime for those who didn't work on Sundays, who went to maybe garden centres or visited gardens again. When we go back to ye olde newspaper reports where they note of the higher echelons of society and drunkenness and debauchery, and the lower classes can't get into those gardens, one of the main reasons some of them were actually opened up to the greater public. I'll put this question to you, that how the RHS has been perceived over a 30-40 year period has certainly changed, and they have made a conscious effort, in my opinion, to make horticulture more accessible to not just Royal Horticultural Society, let's say Chelsea Flower Show or Wisley or their new Bridgewater Garden, but they've made even family memberships available. They've brought gardening to schools. They've brought, you know, when I'm going to Hampton Court Palace Flower Show, I see the train stations have Britain in Bloom. The effect that that institution, I use that word very graciously, has had on society in large, and how it has evolved over the last 40 years is colossal. It's almost like as if it slowly but surely rebranded itself and made it absolutely accessible to almost every facet of society.
Yeah, it's. I agree with what you say. What began as an academic upper class, you know, group of people. I mean, there at the first meeting was Joseph Banks, the great botanist, naturalist, scientist, and traveller, of course, because he travelled with Captain Cook. So he was influential in the establishing of the gardens at Kew as well. So, you know, you had people who were had financial and academic clout, and it was definitely an upper class gardening club, if you like. And for many years, it was sort of basically the home for those who had country estates and who gardened. And then it started to change because gardening became open to all. The RHS actually published the vegetable garden display to help the war effort and the fruit garden displayed. And it started then looking at people and trying to help the general gardener. And little by little, it's become transformed until, just as you say, today, you know, gardening has become a hugely popular hobby for all sorts of classes and races. You know, it's the kind of thing that everybody can be involved with, even if you're only gardening perhaps, you know, a couple of African violets on a windowsill. Everybody likes to garden. Everybody loves plants. There's this sort of resurgence of interest in houseplants that, you know, the hipsters are really driving with their sort of loft living in trendy places like Shoreditch and like, you know, everybody's hooked up to gardening in some way, shape or form, or whether it's on an allotment or whatever it may be. So there almost seems to be an innate passion to garden. And the RHS is really trying to satisfy all these different people from different backgrounds and provide them with the means whereby they can develop their hobby and can continue enjoying it effectively and efficiently. And it even comes down to, you know, reducing food miles. You know, we've not really mentioned, we always think of ornamental gardening, but people were gardening allotments, and, you know, your grandpa and my grandpa and going back, they all had a vegetable garden, and that was fundamental to feed the family. So gardening ornamentally has always been seen as an indulgence. We do more of that now. But veggie gardening was an essential to survival, and lots of people still like that. And with the advent of the interest in cooking as well, you know, people go, oh yeah, let's grow something different. Let's grow something tasty. We understand that, you know, there's no carbon footprint when you grow at home. So wherever the RHS can research and can encourage with model gardens, with education, with allowing people, you know, in the new garden at Bridgewater, there are going to be areas used by different charities. So again, they'll be able to come in and garden these specific plots. And they'll be working with refugees who have, you know, been displaced from their homes. And there are people like you and I, you know, have had sort of terrible traumas, displaced from their homes, and, you know, ended up in a flat somewhere in Salford or whatever. And the one thing that they love is gardening. They in their homelands, were very much more in touch with the soil in a lot of cases. So again, the RHS is providing for a group of people that, you know, have never had to really be considered before. I suppose you could say, you know, Peter, that it's a really exciting time for horticulture because there are so many demands being placed on it, and challenges are coming at them from all angles, and they're trying to place themselves to be able to respond to these challenges in the most effective and positive way.
The other side of this, Matt, and unknowns maybe to the listeners of the Sod Show, is I would be aware of a large gaggle, shall I call it, of Royal Horticultural Society employees. If I take a young Matthew Potash, who took over at Wisley, Ben Brace, who would be involved in the RHS Bridgewater Garden, the PR team, who operate a little bit behind the scenes, the show managers, Anna Skibnevsky-Ball, Isabel Coulter at Tatton, Helen Bohm, I say the RHS, have a really young, up-and-coming, energetic team who are brimmed full of ideas. If I look at Tatton, you have Bus Stop Boulevard. Some of the prison services were designing gardens there. Pete O'Dolph and Amory Powell at Hampton last year. And you had yours truly and Ed Burnham at RHS Cardiff this year. And I should add, in between all of that, and in between all of what I note as a rebrand and a young, up-and-coming staff or team, that seems to have been built at least quietly or not overly announced. The funny side of it is it's only when I ended up on stage with Terry Walton, and you end up at that fully packed house, and then you realise, hold on a second, there are polar opposites that wouldn't have happened 30 or 40 years ago at any RHS show, but there literally is something for everybody when you take a grandstand back and look at it. And albeit people may be critical of the RHS, that to me is a little bit like show gardening. You're allowed not like that one, and you are allowed also to like that one.
Yeah, I think the it's interesting that you say, because what they've very shrewdly done is that they've looked at their management teams and they have infused, if you like, the experienced people with youth. So you've got the energy and dynamism of youth and the ideas, the fresh ideas, and that incredible energy that goes with it. But also they've kept some and introduced some people who are really great sort of steerers of projects and have got experience. So I think it's that amalgamation of youthful enthusiasm. The different sexes, you know, there's a lot more ladies working there now. That brings a different angle to it, a different approach, which is good. So you've got male and female thought patterns, if you like. You've got the middle-aged experienced and the old experienced and the young knowledgeable. So this whole mix is very potent. And what they've done is they've looked, I think, at places like the Eden Project, which were the catalyst for all this. They've got Dr. Alistair Griffiths, or Professor Alistair Griffiths, there overseeing the sciences. Now, I wrote a book years ago called Gardening at Eden and How to Do It at Home. And it was about, as the title explains, the horticulture of the Eden Project. And I interviewed lots and lots of people there, including Alistair Griffiths. And he's just one of these brilliant people, so full of ideas. You know, he's just got big brains, lots of ideas, lots of dynamism, a fantastic bloke. Well, he's been drafted into the team. And then you've got people like Gerald Clover, you know, again, plant health, massive for the RHS, you know, leaders in research, leaders by example. And then you've got Gerald Clover, and he had worked for, I think it's about 15, 20 years, if not longer, for the New Zealand plant health. And again, they are the best in the world. You know, they have to be, because New Zealand depends so much on agriculture and horticulture for the whole country's economy. It's vital. So again, he's brought their ideas, their thoughts, their processes, if you like, to the RHS. And with their new, you know, Centre for Science and Learning at Wisley, the $160 million investment in all the gardens, in individual projects there to improve things. These are all, I think, upgrades that have been undertaken because of the example set by innovators like Tim Schmidt and the ideas that came from the Eden Project. I got to know the Eden Project really well. And I just used to think it was like a bubbling cauldron of intellect and ideas and really bright, free-thinking people. And that's what the RHS has, you know, taken some of that. And it's now all these developments, like the Centre for Science and Learning, the new gardens around it, the new Welcome Centre, Bridgewater, you know, it's doing so many things. There's massive projects. And I think this is really giving the organisation a shake-up and putting it at the forefront of horticulture. Because, as we've mentioned several times, horticulture is so important for, you know, for well-being, for climate change. You know, horticulture, little old horticulture that you and I, you know, joined years ago when we were lads, has gone from just being this pleasant pastime to, you know, having a massive impact, and the RHS are endeavouring to respond to this. And I think one of the interesting things about, I couldn't quite work out why they'd asked me to write the book, you know, me in particular, but I think it was because they knew that I had something to do with the RHS, but wasn't steeped in the RHS. So I was, you know, was independent, really. And I judge for them. I'm on one of their committees, but I'm not actively involved day to day. And so I would be able to look at it independently. And I was just, and, you know, I would urge people to, you know, to buy the book, not just because I've written it, because it really is such a revelation, such an eye-opener, and it's completely changed my opinion of the RHS. And though it does have its detractors, I would urge the detractors to read the book. I would urge anybody who's interested in horticulture, particularly members of the Royal Horticultural Society, to read that book, because the RHS is doing so much for us all. And at the end of the day, if it improves our quality of gardening, our pleasure and our happiness at sort of digging and delving and harvesting and sowing, then if we can do that with a greater level of understanding and success, then it will increase our enjoyment. You know, so horticulture is so fundamental to our existence and survival. And the RHS are actually trying to sort of improve the quality of the product at home, but also trying to improve our understanding of horticulture through scientific means.
Matt, you touched on it briefly just there. RHS members, a couple of weeks ago that they announced they had just passed 500,000 members. This is a 215-year-old institution, I should add, and at 500,000 members, for which involved in that behind the scenes, for those of you unaware, Chris Young, hello Chris, if you're listening, well I know you are, they have also the RHS Garden Magazine, they have two podcasts, and to put that in context, just a sidetrack subcategory in Peter's head again, in 2016, when the Sideshow went up for award at the Garden Media Guild annual ceremony in the Savoy Hotel, there were only but the BBC, the Royal Horticultural Society, a yours truly as the freak or the oddball in the room, and the Guardian newspaper. Even in podcasting terms, which has taken a little bit of a craft beer style of a trajectory, the RHS were there before it all kicked off alongside myself, and they were they seemed to be ahead of the curve before the curve even started.
Yes, I think, and that's, you know, that's what they, you know, they're aiming to do. And that's why they bring in, you know, visionaries. They've got these visionaries. They've got these ideas people. It's essential to have, you know, the ideas people driving it and trying to publicize horticulture. And I think, you know, I'm so pleased that they've reached their sort of 500,000 members. In fact, there's quite a few more now. You know, it really is gaining some momentum, because with each member and with each visit to a flower show, it's actually generating income for the society and their research. What one thing, and I don't know why this has stuck in my mind, but one thing that made me go, oh, really? That's excellent. I've changed my opinion. And it's this, is the fact that Chelsea Flower Show, which is very expensive to get into, but Chelsea Flower Show is a major fundraiser for the society. So it's not just, oh, the tickets are really expensive, it's really elitist, I can't go. Actually, because people want to go, and they, you know, they will pay a high price, and hey, you can sit and watch it on the television anyway. It's not quite the same as going, but you get a really good overview because there's masses of BBC coverage. But those really expensive tickets are funding the RHS's research. And it had never occurred to me before at all that it was actually a Chelsea Flower Show, flower show at Cardiff, Tatton, all those that you've mentioned, Peter, they're all fundraisers for the RHS. And suddenly when you go, oh, well, I don't mind paying a little bit over the odds for that, in which case, because it's allowing them or encouraging them to bring young people into horticulture, to encourage young garden designers to do the work with the schools, with old people in the communities, for Green and Grey Britain. All that has to be bankrolled, and it's bankrolled by its membership, by the fees that they pay, and also the extras that they gain from setting up the shows. And the shows themselves are costly to run, but they do, you know, the aim is to make a profit, and the profit is then ploughed back into its, you know, its charitable remit and the charity work that it does.
And that is all we have time for on this episode of The Sideshow. I had done a different outro, hold on, because I don't know whether you can hear that. I've got a squeaky chair thing here. I could do with some WD-40 to ease that squeakiness. Yeah, I'm unsure where I go with these outros as well. But Matt will return to finish this conversation with me, not next week, but the week after, in true Sideshow style. I don't know what it is. It's not a Pavlov's dog. It's more maybe a law of diminishing returns, in economic term, in a nutshell, where you turn around and say one more tune, and then I sort of give you one more tune, and then you turn around and say, well, that's a bit much of him. So, yeah, I gotta go. You have a great weekend in the great outdoors, or a great week in the great outdoors. Thanks for listening. Take care. Don't forget to hug your mother. Play safe. All right. Bye-bye.